Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled International Criminal Justice. My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us the Honorable Hassan Boubacar Diallo, the Chief Justice of the Republic of Gambia and former Chief Prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, the ICTR. We also have Eli Rosenbaum, the Director of the Human Rights Enforcement Policy and Strategy in the Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section of the U.S. Department of Justice, as well as Arthur Traldi, a former war crimes prosecutor for the former Yugoslavia and ICTR. Moderating today is Mr. Adam R. Perlman, the Managing Director of LexPat Global Services. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Adam, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Greg. And to everyone on the call, we hope that you're safe and healthy. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining what promises to be an intriguing conversation with three distinguished practitioners in international criminal law and human rights related to issues surrounding the arrest and future prosecution of one of the world's most wanted fugitives, Felicien Kabuga. To echo Greg, I should say at the outset that any views I might express during the course of this call are my own and do not necessarily reflect the policy or position of any government agency or other organization I have worked for over the course of my career. But as I mentioned a moment ago, we will be talking today about the case against Felicien Kabuga and lessons learned from decades of pursuing and bringing to justice many of the world's most notorious war criminals, human rights violators, and genocidaires. Kabuga was arrested in May outside of Paris after a 26-year-long manhunt. He had been indicted before the ICTR on 7 counts of genocide, conspiracy, and related crimes for his role in perpetrating the Rwandan genocide of 1994. Kabuga was an influential businessman and political activist who amassed much of his wealth from owning tea farms and other ventures. Prosecutors say that Kabuga's actions include importing and supplying many thousands of machetes to the militias that were leading the killing spree, as well as using the radio station he founded, RTLM, to incite the violence by broadcasting propaganda that urged mass slaughter. As the tide turned in Rwanda in June 1994, Kabuga fled and the manhunt began, which at one point included the U.S. offering a $5 million reward for information leading to his arrest. Public reports suggest that at least one person who tried to help bring Kabuga to justice was murdered. Rumors and clues of his movements throughout Africa and Europe followed him as a sophisticated and well-resourced network of powerful friends worked to keep him hidden over 2.5 decades. Then the coronavirus pandemic took hold, borders closed, and he had nowhere to go before his arrest on May 16th. Today we will talk about the charges, the manhunt, and what challenges prosecutors are going to face as they present the case against Kabuga. We are truly honored today to be joined by three people whose expertise on these and other issues related to the case are among the best in the world. First, the Honorable Hassan Diallo's career has been marked by distinguished service in his home country, the Gambia, and in international tribunals. In the Gambia, his positions have included Solicitor General, Attorney General and Minister of Justice, Justice of the Supreme Court, and now he serves as its Chief Justice. Between his seats on the court, he spent 13 years as the prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and its successor, Residual Mechanism for Criminal Tribunals, having a deep involvement in crafting the current charges against Kabuga and the international search for him. Eli Rosenbaum has been Director of Human Rights Enforcement Policy and Strategy in the U.S. Department of Justice's Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section for the last decade. For more than 20 years before that, he was director of DOJ's Office of Special Investigations, where he earned accolades as the world's most successful Nazi hunter. Eli has spent his career tracking gross human rights violators, certainly those from World War II, but also from more modern atrocity-pointed conflicts, and removing them from the United States if and when they are found here. He has worked the coldest of cold cases and introduced into court some of the oldest evidence of criminal activity that judges have ever considered. Arthur Trawley is a noted international criminal litigator who served for 7 years as a prosecutor for the ICTY and before that served in the chambers of the ICTR. He's a sought-after expert by governments and NGOs in need of training or assistance for international criminal, human rights, and rule of law matters. He is, among other things, a member of the International Association of Prosecutors and a co-chair of the International Criminal Law Committee of the ABA Section of International Law. Each speaker will take about 10 minutes to discuss certain aspects of the Kabuga case, either that case specifically or international criminal cases in general. I will then ask them a few questions before opening the floor to audience Q&A. And with that, Chief Justice Jallo, thank you again for joining us. Please tell us a bit about the ICTR's case against Kabuga and the search for him while you were there.
Thank you very much, Adam. I'm very happy to be on this panel today. And I'm very pleased that Kabuga has finally been arrested and is going to be brought to justice. It's a big, big blow for justice for the victims of the genocide of Rwanda. I congratulate the current prosecutor and his tracking team for this major achievement. I first got to know about Kabuga when I joined the ICTR in 2003 as the chief prosecutor. Against the background of the Security Council resolution, which now gave the tribunal a deadline for finishing, that end of 2012, for finishing and closing down. So as the prosecutor at that time, my immediate task was then to now develop a list of cases which we were convinced we could do, we could prosecute within that time frame. And at the same time, develop a list of cases which deserve prosecution, but which we couldn't handle and which we thought could then be referred elsewhere to other jurisdictions. Kabuga's name, of course, came up in the first list as one of the big targets. In developing that list, we were guided by a number of considerations, the status of the person, the seriousness of the offense, and so on and so forth, and the kind of offenses involved. Kabuga really fitted all the criteria in the sense that he was a big businessman. He was founder and president of the RTLM radio, which played a very, very prominent role in the genocide, in inciting public hatred for Tutsis, in actually directing people to where Tutsis were in order for them to be killed. He was very much involved in the management of the radio station and in his programming as well. He used his wealth also, his resources, his properties, his transportation system, his money, in order to support and fund the Interahamwe, that is the militia of the ruling party, which had a lot of responsibility for the killing of the Tutsi. Then he was also involved in, from the evidence we had in the purchase and distribution of weapons, arms and cutlass machete, which eventually were supplied to the Interahamwe and to the military. And we had instances where he was also personally involved in inciting people to commit these crimes of genocide. So he fitted the bill, and he was one of our main indictees. So I actually signed his indictment on the 11th of March, on the 17th of March, 2011. That's the last indictment we had. There had been previous ones, but we refined them and had them amended and confirmed by the chamber. So the last one was the indictment of 17th of March 2011. I think Kabuga's case highlights two major problems with international justice. One is the tracking and apprehension of fugitives. In the case of Rwanda, all the fugitives whom we had listed for prosecution had actually left Rwanda. They were not in Rwanda. So we had to track them and find them and bring them back to Arusha. That was a major challenge. The second is that because of the length of time it took to arrest people like Kabuga and others, And because the evidence at the ICTR was largely witness testimony as opposed to documentary evidence, there was always the difficulty, the risk, and not just the risk, but often also the actual loss of evidence. Witnesses died, witnesses relocated, witnesses could not be reached. They may decide not to testify anymore. So you have the problem of the challenge of preserving the evidence in order to make sure it is available eventually when the fugitive is arrested after a very long time, as in the case of Kabuga, half a century after the commission of the crimes. We had major challenges in the tracking of Kabuga. We had clear evidence, documentary evidence actually, that after the genocide, he fled to Kenya, and he settled there and he carried on business there. We had actually little or no cooperation from the Kenyan authorities at the time on trying to locate him in Kenya and secure his arrest. There were reports, if we had credible ones too, of him being protected by very high levels within Kenya. It was the only case, Kabuga's was the only case where the failure to cooperate by a state member of the UN was so serious that we had to report it to the Security Council. We reported Kenya officially to the Security Council for failing to cooperate in the search and the arrest for Kenya, of Kabuga in Kenya. So his case was symptomatic of kind of the challenges in tracking, the problem of securing state cooperation, etc. Eventually, there was evidence that he had left the country. He had left Kenya. We couldn't get any evidence as to where he had gone. So we kept on searching. And up to the time I left in 2012, we had indications he could be somewhere in Africa. He could be in Europe. We kept on looking. And I'm glad that eventually he's been arrested, being brought to justice. Evidence preservation, we tried to deal with it through a rule change. As I said, when it comes to, for instance, prosecuting the Nazi war criminals, it's perhaps a relatively easy exercise in the sense that there's a lot of documentary evidence. When it comes to prosecuting genocidaires from Rwanda half a century later, you are likely to run into a situation where many of your eyewitnesses may not be alive anymore. Or if they are alive, they may be reluctant to testify, or they may be sick or aged. We tried to get around that, preserve the evidence in 2012 by changing the rules in order to empower the prosecutor where an arrest could not be effected within a reasonable time to call for the prosecutor to call all his witnesses before the judge in the tribunal, have them testify on oath, and their testimony is subject to cross-examination. It is certified. So that in the event that the accused is arrested several years down the line and the witness is not available, the judges, the trial judges now, have the discretion to rely on that preserved testimony. So when Kabuga goes on trial now, I mean, that we did in the case of Kabuga. And before I left in 2012, we had actually called all our witnesses before a judge and certified their evidence. So if Kabuga is being tried now, we expect that if witnesses are not available, some of our key witnesses are not available, that their evidence would have been preserved and the trial judges will be at liberty to rely on it. So we're looking forward very much to his trial. As I said, his case was handed over by the ICTR to the mechanism, I believe around 2012, together with two other cases. Those three cases were the only ones which we thought involved sufficiently high-level targets for their case to be referred to the mechanism, which is the successor of the ICTR, for it to prosecute them whenever they are arrested. So we're looking forward to that day when he is transferred to our ocean and make to account in due process, of course, for all that he's alleged to have done. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Justice. Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. It's really, really interesting background and somewhat heartbreaking about possible Kenyan complicity. But I have so many questions for you, but I'll roll through the other speakers first, and then we'll I'll ask a couple of follow up questions that everybody can weigh in on. And with that, Eli, you, sir, are the longest serving prosecutor of war criminals and human rights violators in history. And you have seen the coldest of the cold, like I said. Could you please provide some insights on the issues with getting such old evidence into court, how judges tend to view it, and the legal issues that you've seen with genocide errors or issues of people accused of violations of crimes against humanity or war crimes.
Sure. Many thanks. It's great to be with you, Adam, a very valued former DOJ colleague. Despite your comparatively young age, you've already had a storied career in and out of federal service. It's also a special privilege to be a panelist alongside two heroes in the global quest for justice on behalf of the victims of human rights crimes, Justice Jallo, whom I had the great good fortune to meet years ago at a conference sponsored by the Robert H. Jackson Center, and Arthur Trowdy, whom I am meeting, quote unquote, on this call for the first time, but whose reputation certainly precedes him. Having worked on U.S. cases involving crimes committed in Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia, and working in an office headed by Teresa McHenry, who served for a time as a prosecutor at the ICTY, I have a particularly deep appreciation for the challenges that both of my fellow panelists have faced and surmounted in these enormously important cases. If I can be permitted to send one other shout out to my friend and former DOJ boss, John Malcolm, who has participated in many of these Federalist Society telefora, is that the plural? And who is perhaps on this call, but who in any event is surely known to most of you. John is one of the unsung heroes of the World War II Nazi cases. During the years that, as a criminal division deputy assistant attorney general, he supervised the office that I then headed, the Office of Special Investigations, OSI. Today, he wears multiple hats, but his home base is as director of the Meese Center at the Heritage Foundation. I will always be hugely grateful for the strong support and unfailingly wise guidance he gave us as we at OSI raced the clock in the Nazi cases, trying to secure a measure of justice before the so-called biological solution to those cases might render continued prosecution impossible. The arrest in May of longtime ICTR fugitive Felicien Kabuga is an appropriate impetus for this forum. Since his case is an ongoing prosecution, I can't comment on it in any detail, but I do want to note that the ICTR mechanism, like the ICTY, has been one that the U.S. government fully supported, and also that the State Department had a longstanding monetary reward outstanding for information leading to Kabuga's apprehension. Although the ICTR was created in the very year in which the Rwandan genocide was perpetrated, it has now been, as Adam said, as Justice Jallo said, more than a quarter of a century since that ghastly crime was committed. Most of the human rights cases that my office, the Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section, prosecutes similarly involve a conduct that occurred many years ago. So my colleagues and I, alas, are well familiar with the challenges of working often ultra cold cases. Emblematic of those cases are such prosecutions by HRSP as these three. Mladen Mitrovic was convicted in Georgia in 2016 of naturalization fraud for concealing his involvement in the ethnic cleansing of Bosnia in the early 1990s while serving as a brutal guard of prisoners held by the Bosnian Serb army. Gilberto Jordan was convicted in Florida in 2010 of an older crime, concealing his participation in the mass murder of nearly all of the inhabitants of Dos Eras, Guatemala, in 1982. And to go back in time still further in terms of the underlying activity, Friedrich Karl Berger, a former Nazi concentration camp guard, we won a removal order against him in U.S. Immigration Court in Tennessee just this past February after a two-day evidentiary hearing. The passage of so much time between the commission of a crime and the commencement of a trial almost invariably complicates the process of proving a case. As Justice Jallo indicated, witnesses may have died, they may suffer memory loss, surviving witnesses can change their mind about testifying, evidence can go astray. Because of the extreme lateness of the date, it's 2020 after all, the Berger case was the first Nazi concentration camp guard case we have ever tried in which there were no survivors available to testify. So we proved our case with documents, admissions, expert testimony, and the like. My office has responsibility for prosecuting criminal cases under the Title 18, genocide, war crimes, torture, child soldiers, female genital mutilation, and immigration and naturalization fraud statutes. We can also bring civil denaturalization cases. And as to participants in World War II acts of Nazi-sponsored persecution, we can bring, as in the Berger case, removal cases as well. In our enforcement work, which we like to think is part of a worldwide effort that arguably began at Nuremberg in 1945 to rid the world of the scourge of human rights crime, we face, in addition to the cold case type proof challenges I mentioned, other challenges that are common around the world in that effort. For example, time and again, access to key evidence, including the crime scene, is impossible because the regime that perpetrated the crimes is still in power, or for other reasons, the government at the scene of the crimes refuses to cooperate. I suppose Arthur can give his own examples. An example in our work was the former Soviet Union, which declined to allow Western investigators or researchers into its archives, archives that collectively housed the world's largest number of surviving captured Nazi documents, essential evidence in almost all Nazi cases. I vividly recall questioning a major Nazi criminal, Alexandros Balakis, in Norwood, Massachusetts, in the early 1980s. He admitted serving as wartime head of the Lithuanian counterpart of the Gestapo for Vilnius province during World War II, but he denied any involvement in crimes. We turned to the Soviet Union, which occupied Lithuania at the time, and they told us, no, we can't find any documents that he signed proving his wartime activities. It took almost a decade before we could get our own staff historian investigator into the archives in newly free Lithuania, but it took the collapse of the USSR to make that access possible. And in those archives, we found proof that enabled us to establish in federal court that the Lakis shared responsibility for some 50,000 murders of Jews. Another challenge we face that isn't outside the experience of other prosecutors is that our statutory tool chest doesn't always provide what we need. For example, if a person participated abroad in the persecution of others on the basis of race, religion, national origin, political opinion, they are statutorily ineligible under federal law for asylum or refugee status. And if they conceal that participation and gain entry, we can prosecute. But if they entered by obtaining a regular U.S. immigrant visa, they haven't necessarily violated any statute, their entrance may have been lawful. So, for example, someone who persecuted Coptic Christians in Egypt or Uyghur Muslims in China can't come in as a refugee or asylee, but they are eligible for a regular U.S. immigrant visa. Some in Congress tried to close that loophole more than four decades ago, but all they were able to enact was a bill narrowly targeted at individuals whose persecutory conduct was committed on behalf of the former Nazi government of Germany and its allies. Similarly, our tool chest lacks one statute that nearly every comparable legal system has long had, and the ICTR and ICTY both had, a crimes against humanity criminal statute. So many of the worst crimes, including the archetypal constitutive offense of extermination, aren't genocide, but rather crimes against humanity. The case of the Cambodian dictator Pol Pot is perhaps the most notorious example. He had the blood of a million or more people on his hands, but those crimes on the whole were genocide, were crimes against humanity, rather, not genocide. And I might add that the United States, ironically, perhaps engineered the world courtroom debut, so to speak, of crimes against humanity when we tried the principal surviving leaders at Nuremberg fully 75 years ago, and Holocaust crimes, so to speak, crimes of the extermination of the Jews, was tried as a crime against humanity. And those crimes continue to be committed, right? Secretary of State Pompeo has spoken powerfully and movingly about crimes against humanity being perpetrated by Syria's Assad regime. As all of us who read the news know, Syria is but one example. One of my favorite books is the 2011 human rights memoir of my former congressman, Frank Wolf, Prisoner of Conscience is the name. And in the book, he recounts the Herculean efforts that he, his chief congressional partner across the aisle, Holocaust survivor Tom Lantos, and others made to draw the efforts they made to draw attention to such crimes and inspire, when they could, meaningful U.S. government action to stop them. It's depressing, but essential and inspiring reading. And one thing we know from post-war history is that the United States, as the most generous nation the world has ever seen for accepting immigrants, my late parents among them, by the way, will continue to experience the entry of participants in such horrific crimes, despite the best efforts that our government makes to identify and exclude them. They shouldn't gain perpetual safe haven in this great country, and in particular, surviving victims of those crimes who've made new homes here should not continue to run the risk of encountering their former tormentors here in their newly adopted homeland. And that's actually happened, including in the well-known case of a torturer who was living in Georgia. I'll close by saying that my office has a staff of about 40 professionals, attorneys, historians, paralegals, and support personnel, all of whom work indefatigably on these cases and also on cases in our two other portfolios, so to speak, alien smuggling and international violent crime. There's a lot of overlap there. And we receive great support from the criminal division and DOJ leadership above the level of the division, and also from our many domestic and foreign law enforcement partners and from NGOs and members of the public who assist us. In our human rights work, we're especially grateful for the cooperation of surviving victims here and abroad, men and women, and sometimes children, who courageously testify about the depredations that have been perpetrated against them, their families, their ethnic and racial communities, and so often their co-religionists. So thank you again to the Society and to Adam for the invitation to participate here today.
Eli, thank you so much for your decades of service to the country and to that endeavor of bringing to justice some of the worst among us across the globe. We're all in your debt for the work that you and your colleagues do, and I'm proud that I was affiliated with you at some point for just a moment in time. But Arthur, from your experience in both chambers, well, in chambers in ICTR and then as a prosecutor in ICTY, what would be how would prosecutors typically proceed in a cold case at an international tribunal like what we're about to see with Kabuga?
Thanks, Adam. It's just an incredible honor to be part of this panel with Justice Jallow and with Eli and with you as well. And I wanted to specifically note something I heard Eli say, a phrase, depressing but essential and inspiring. And I think he was talking about a book, but it's such a brilliant articulation, all of those things at once, of the nature of working in this field, that I wanted to acknowledge it and remember it for myself to plagiarize probably in the future. But it's a beautiful expression of the type of work that the prosecutors on this case are faced with. So I think the first thing to remember is what's at stake here. And, you know, we talk about propaganda in this case and about financing the purchases of weapons. And of course, these are all things that prosecutors and courts can do some damage on if they define them too broadly. And so I think it's worth remembering what we are talking about here just from looking at the indictment and the open source material that's available. And you know, the indictment that Justice Jallow signed cites example after example of things that aren't euphemisms, but are direct calls for murder and murder on an industrial scale. We're talking about almost 1 million people over the course of 100 days. And proving, so I say that first as a reminder of the type of circumstances we're talking about, but also to frame one of the strategic challenges that prosecutors in a cold mass atrocity case are faced with. And that's without doing a 50-year trial against a gentleman in his 80s, how many of those close to 1 million deaths are you going to attempt to prove, and with what evidence? Because Kabuga is a senior figure, and what you typically expect in a case like that at the tribunal is an allegation on the part of the prosecution, and here it's expressed through four separate and interweaving conspiracies in this indictment. But you expect an assertion that he and some other leaders of the country together used forces and institutions under their control to carry out this crime that is massive in scale, incredibly grave in implementation, and carried out through all of these individual crimes that you have to think about how to prove. And as Justice Jallow said, it's heavily witness-driven in the Rwanda cases. So all of that takes court time, and you have less opportunity than you might in one of the Yugoslavia cases or in a Nazi case to do it through documentary evidence. Eli was talking about having proved up a case against a camp guard last year solely through documentary evidence. And so I think one of the things that the prosecutors will be thinking about is, how do we balance the need to prove enough of that criminality, first, to ensure we're giving the victims a voice, and second, to ensure that the judges have the right understanding as they evaluate the evidence of the nature of the campaign that was being waged here, that this wasn't, that there was no chance, based on what was happening between April 9th and 23rd or so of 1994, that there was no chance that Kabuga would have thought, if he provided weapons in late April, that he was providing them to something that was simply a war. And balancing the need for efficiency with the need to provide enough detail to get that information into the record. And so they'll be making an enormous amount, high stakes and fairly fine decisions, just about which specific pieces to use to assemble that case. And what you typically expect to hear from them is a picture of what's happening in different parts of the country to help show that whole campaign and where the different parts of it fit in. And examples of here's your broadcast on X date saying kill the people in this mosque. Here's your crime-based evidence about what happened the next day in that mosque, who did the killing, in an attempt to make clear the linkages between those individual crimes and the specific person who's on trial here, which is Kabuga, and the actions of him, his radio station, and his broadcasters. For all the reasons that Eli and Justice Jallow set out, that's an enormous challenge to do in a way that is efficient, reliable, and meets your burden in a trial like this. But it's as Eli again said, it's depressing, essential, and inspiring. And it'll be really interesting to see the choices they make and how they proceed as we get closer to the beginning of trial.
Thanks, Arthur. And again,
thank you all for, I think, what can only be described as a tutorial in how international criminal justice works for something like this. Arthur, you hinted at it, and I think everybody realizes, you know, Kabuga is now 84 years old. And on the one hand, you know, Eli's old office, OSI, and now HRSP, the Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section, have brought removal actions against Nazis well into their 90s. But on the other hand, you know, Arthur, as you implied, the international tribunals have a reputation for moving very slowly. Perhaps the best example of that being Milosevic dying, in ICTY custody before the end of trial. You know, and that trial had gone on for 4 years, and he was only 64. So, for any of you, how might Kabuga's age be a factor in this? You know, Arthur had said, well, you want this to be, you know, we want this to be efficient, but also being able to really link these episodes and to Kabuga's actions. Are there any other ways in which the tribunal really kind of has to take into account his age and moving forward expeditiously, but within the bounds of the rule of law?
Well, it's quite age, if I may come in at that.
Yeah, yes, sir.
Yes, that's true. He's quite age now, and I do wish him good health and long life, and so that we can see justice taking place for the victims of Rwanda. Let me just get back to one point that I think, in addition to the measures taken to preserve evidence, which might help the prosecution in this particular case, is also the fact that there are certain things which the prosecution will not need to prove anymore in any trial relating to the genocide in Rwanda. For many years, until I think 2012, the prosecution had to keep on proving the occurrence of the genocide. But the court has taken judicial notice of that fact now. So it's not something that requires proof anymore in any trial in the ICTR or in the mechanism it's successful. So the prosecution will be focusing basically on the linkage, the connection between the accused and the events which have been established as having occurred. So it could be that could help in shortening the trial itself. The preservation of the evidence could help also in plugging any gaps where witnesses are for some reason unavailable. Other than that, well, we've had experience we've had our own Milosevic at the ICTR. We lost Richard Girorera in the course of trial. He was one of the leaders of the ruling party at the time. And, so, in a way, the victims were robbed of justice because of the long process of the trial and his death as well. We do hope Kabuga survives the trial so that at the end of the day, we can see justice done.
Certainly. And we've mentioned a couple of times the rule changes from mm-hmm. 2012. And so you specifically had mentioned the efforts to preserve testimony. And mm-hmm. we certainly have similar mechanisms in the sense of using deposition testimony domestically in the event that witnesses are unavailable. But in the international context, in a case like this, and anybody can answer, how can we assure effective cross-examination of, during the course of taking that testimony? You had mentioned that witnesses are cross-examined, but can you talk a little bit more about how that was done to defeat the challenges that are sure to come that Kabuga himself did not have an opportunity to confront the witnesses against him?
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's an issue there about the cross-examination. The counsel who represent the accused to assist the court in this case are selected by the court itself, presumably because the accused is at large, is a fugitive. The counsel for the defense are not getting instructions from him as to the nature of the defense that he's putting up, and so the questions to put to the prosecution witnesses. But in all the cases where we have done these evidence preservation proceedings, there has been some very active, vigorous cross-examination of the witnesses led by the prosecution and cross-examination by defense counsel, and quite extensive, I must say, perhaps even without the benefit of any specific instructions from the accused. On the other hand, it's absolutely necessary to preserve the evidence. And if the accused person decide to be absent by their own volition, they should not use that as a reason to forestall any evidence preservation proceeding. The evidence needs to be preserved in the interest of justice as well.
Thanks, sir. Arthur, Eli, do you have anything else on that?
Eli Rosenbaum here. I would just mention that when dealing with elderly defendants, one finds that sometimes they will, their attorneys will claim that they lack, they're suffering from some mental disability now that makes it unfair for them to be prosecuted. And occasionally that's true, and then a responsible prosecutor doesn't continue. But I will say it's not uncommon, especially in human rights cases, for older defendants to feign mental health issues. And I think of some cases where we've seen that, and also civil rights cases where that's occurred in the United States. I recall particularly some 20 years ago, the case of Bobby Frank Cherry in Alabama, who was charged belatedly with complicity in the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, which killed four African-American girls and grievously wounded another, perhaps the most atrocious crime of the civil rights era. And Cherry was examined by a court-appointed physician who concluded that he was suffering from dementia. And there it appeared the case would end. We read about that in the newspaper up here. I had my deputy reach out to the state prosecutor. My deputy was from Alabama herself, and explained what our experiences have been with medical specialists who can determine whether a claim like that is correct, or whether instead, as the doctors say, the defendant is malingering, meaning feigning, mental health challenges. And in the case of Bobby Frank Cherry, they did proceed ahead with a little bit of help from us, very little bit, and proved that he was in fact feigning illness, and the case went forward and he was convicted.
Arthur?
Yeah, I think the thing I would think about on those two points, first on the cross-examination issue that you mentioned, is that one of the tools that you'll try to use as a prosecutor to find those efficiencies is looking for corroboration wherever you can. Evidence is preserved by Justice Shallow and his team. That's very important. As you say, there may be some instances where that preserved evidence can't be rechallenged. And what you'll want to do as a prosecutor is look through your record and have truth detectors to point to the judges and their lawyers to say, look, even if that cross-examination wasn't fully under instructions, you can tell this witness is telling the truth for these reasons. But that requires a robust record and detailed attention to your corroboration. And then I think I agree with Eli on the second point, naturally, about the health issues, and say it's something that I'm sure the prosecutors and the rest of the folks in the office at the mechanism are working with the, I think still the French authorities to make sure that they have good records and the ability to properly litigate any health issues that come up, just to to ensure that the process is fair to everybody, not just to Kabuga, but to the many victims of the crimes who have an interest in seeing a fair and rigorous trial.
Thank you all. I'm going to ask one more question. I'm going to ask the uncomfortable question before we open it up to audience Q&A. Arthur, in your comments, you had reminded us that we're talking about 1 million people over 100 days. And for those of us lawyers who are terrible at math, that's 10,000 murders a day. And given the gravity of these crimes, we know that Rwanda is a Francophone country. Kabuga spoke French, but the uncomfortable question, of course, is whether any of you care to opine on why he may have ended up in France and how he could have lived there undetected.
Hello, Adam.
Yes, sir.
It's a little bit faint. I didn't get that well.
I asked if you could comment on why Kabuga may have ended up in France and how he might have been able to live there undetected.
Well, as I said, the firm evidence we had was that he had entered Kenya and he had lived there and invested businesses. Then we could no longer find him in the country, and we were told he had left. How he had left and to which destination, we never had any evidence to indicate that. But we had a lot of reports about him being in somewhere in Europe, Belgium, France, etc. And we kept on looking for him. But of course, there are many challenges with regard to tracking, because the fugitives don't go by their original names. They change their IDs. After many years, they begin to also know how to hide better. The French, the Belgians, and other countries helped us very hard. They worked very hard, but understandably, of course, not all countries can focus on our cases all the time, because they also have other engagements in the area of law enforcement, and they have to turn their attention to those. But we had help from them, European countries, and from Interpol as well. It's just a very difficult business tracking fugitives who are hiding, especially if there is a network of family and friends which is supporting them in their hiding.
Well, Adam, do you want to go to audience questions?
Eli or Arthur, if you want to comment on this, otherwise we can go to the floor.
I'll defer to Justice Jallet.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to our first caller.
Yes, this is Ed Heimlich in Texas, United States. This is a question for Eli Rosenbaum. I realize that your department is understaffed and very, very busy with many things that are probably much bigger issues than what I have. But I think a phone call from you or someone in your division could probably cure a refusal of the state of Texas to comply with a provision of the international law, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. That was ratified by was written by the United States and eventually ratified by our Senate in 1992. And so I would like to know if you would be willing to assist me with that, if I could contact you later.
Please do contact me. I'm not entirely sure what violation of the ICCPR you're referring to, but I'm happy to look at it and see if it's within our wheelhouse. And if not, perhaps it's the Civil Rights Division or some other component of the department. Please do contact me.
Let's now go to the next caller.
Yes, I'm curious about the value of a judgment in absentia, where you can't reach an individual to punish that individual Is there any value in a judgment in absentia against the government, say the Assad regime or the Chinese Communist Party, once that judgment is entered, even though we can't imprison anybody?
I'm sorry, caller, to whom was that question directed?
I'm sorry, to anybody. You're all experts.
Mr. Chief Justice, I think there's some audio quality issues on your end, so I'm going to mute you for the time being. Arthur, Eli, Adam, do any of you want to respond to that?
Well, I'll just comment that certainly the United States does not try defendants in absentia. Certain other countries do. But we also would try individual cases and controversies and not prosecute governments. So I think that's just a general comment that I can make without having more context as far as exactly what
for me. I think the thing I'd say is that we'll have an interesting test of it next month in international criminal justice, because we will get the trial judgment in Hezbollah trial in The Hague for the assassination of Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri about 15 years ago. It is an in absentia trial because Lebanese law permits in absentia trials. And if you're interested in how much credibility judgments like that can have, then I think watching how people react to that case is the rigorous way to find an answer to the question.
A good point. I would add that there have been other trials in absentia in international human rights cases, perhaps most famously that of Martin Bormann at Nuremberg. The Italian government in World War II cases in the last 20 years has actually prosecuted quite a few people in absentia for the reason that Germany does not extradite its own nationals. It's obviously far from an ideal way to proceed. We actually do that, at least at the state level, I don't know about federal, where an individual is charged and then flees and doesn't show up for trial. At least in some states, the trial can go forward. Again, far from ideal. This goes to the question that I thought you were going to ask when you started talking, when you were referencing, a million victims. And I thought the question was going to be, can you ever really get justice? What does justice mean when you have a death toll of that magnitude and you've got one person, in the dock? And I was going to say, so perhaps you'll forgive me if I try to answer that now, justice in some sense is not possible in a situation like that. I would submit that it's not possible for a single murder, really. So you do this to get the truth determined. You get this to give some closure to the families of the victims and surviving victims, if there are any. You do this to... most of all, to deter future perpetrators, would-be perpetrators of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and other serious international crimes. And I guess I would summarize that by sharing my professional fantasy, which is I like to imagine that somewhere, sometime, that maybe it's already happened or will happen, that an individual is faced with a choice. Do I follow, do I obey a criminal order, or do I find a way to get out of this? And I would like to imagine that that person says to himself or herself, wow, I remember seeing this old guy, a Nazi or something like that, being hauled to court. He was white-haired, and that could be me. If I do this thing, maybe if I can get away for a few months, a few years, I'd like to think that I'm home free. But in these kinds of cases, it seems that the world goes after you forever, even into old age. So I better find a way out of this. So out of this may tell you more than you need to know about my fantasy life, but there it is.
Well, I'd like to give the Chief Justice a chance to respond, even with the audio issue. So I'll unmute you, sir, real quick. And if there's still a audio issue, Arthur, Eli, Adam, feel free to conclude with any of your thoughts, as there are no other callers in the queue.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, the Chief Justice just dropped off. If he calls back in, I'll definitely cede the floor. But in the meantime, Arthur, Eli, do you have anything to conclude on?
I'm going to jump in with noting that Eli, it is a wonderful professional fantasy, and your comments just hinted at what could be whole other phone calls in terms of the philosophical and practical differences between, for example, prosecuting a genocide case versus a crimes against humanity case. In terms of the gray hair having to look over their shoulder for the rest of their lives, I'll note that this is an area where practicing human rights law and counterterrorism law are increasingly having a bunch of overlap, that, you know, in the national security and counterterrorism realm, there's a lot of efforts right now to be better about collecting battlefield evidence, which is critical in a lot of these war crimes and genocide cases, and preserving what investigators find, so that the perpetrators of these crimes, that for very good reason have no statute of limitations, will always have to be looking over their shoulders. And I hope, with the highest hope, that that will, maybe be a deterrent for some in the future, or at least a better way for us to have confidence that we can find these people and hold them accountable for what they've done to their fellow citizens and others.
That's a more eloquent and moving close than anything that I could provide. So I will gladly associate myself, Adam, with those remarks, and thank you again.
I'll do the same, and thank Adam as well, and Eli and Justice Jallow, as well as the Federalist Society, for the opportunity to join all of you today.
Well, thank you all. Greg, please do the honors. You can close it out if there are no other questions.
Perfect. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.